Pastor Bertrand L. Comperé of San Diego.
Tonight I've got something on a little different theme to talk to you about, and that is judgment by fire. The Bible has a good deal to say about fire as a divine manifestation. And don't let anybody tell you that it doesn't mean fire either, because the words used definitely mean that. Sometimes the Bible speaks of fire falling from heaven. For example, in Genesis 19, verse 24, "Then Yahweh rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from Yahweh out of heaven." Now the Hebrew word used there, which is translated fire, the Hebrew word ash, and it means regular, ordinary fire that burns things up. For example, in Exodus 12, verse 8, where it's giving the directions for the Passover supper and cooking the Passover lamb for that supper, "And they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire." And it's that same Hebrew word ash. So you can see that definitely it means fire, hot, capable of burning things. Now, the Bible records quite a number of instances of fire, not simply kindled by man, but fire provided by God. And lest anybody think that this is ancient, primitive superstition, before we're through this evening, we're going to see a lot of instances of exactly the same thing within our own times. Now, the prophet Elijah, for example, was defended by this fire falling from heaven. The king, who didn't like the way Elijah had been calling attention to the king's evil doings, hearing that he was near town, the king sent out a band of soldiers to seize him and bring him in to be killed. So you read in 2 Kings chapter 1, verses 9 and 12, "Then the king sent unto him a captain of 50 with his 50 men. And he went up to him, and behold, he sat on the top of a hill. And the captain spoke unto him, Thou man of God, the king hath said, Come down. And Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, If I be a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And there came down fire from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Again he also sent unto him another captain of 50 with his 50. And he said to him, O man of God, thus hath the king said, Come down quickly. And Elijah answered and said unto them, If I be a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. And again, in both those instances, the fire, it's that Hebrew word ash. It's not lightning, it's fire. Now, God didn't always use fire by way of punishing his enemies. He used it also to demonstrate his pleasure with what was done on his behalf. You remember that Elijah came back to the people, nearly all of whom were worshipers of Baal by that time, and he said, well, let's see who's God. Up on this mountaintop now, let the priests of Baal build an altar, put the wood on the altar and the sacrifice on the wood, but not light it. And I'll build an altar and put wood on it and not light it. Then we'll each call to our God, and let's see which God is able to answer by fire and set the sacrifice burning on his altar. Now, Elijah not only used no fire, but you remember he drenched the
altar and the wood and the sacrifice with a good many barrels of water until it was all sopping wet.
Then you read, "Then the fire of Yahweh fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench." Again, that word Aish. And if you're beginning to wonder whether this can happen, just wait. We'll come to that a little bit later. Now, there are other instances where God caused fire to appear. It doesn't specifically say it fell from heaven, but it appeared where it was needed. You remember Aaron was consecrated as the first high priest, and his sons were made assistant priests. And his two oldest sons, Nadab and Abihu, were a little too impressed with their importance. Now, very careful instructions were given. They couldn't just go blundering into the presence of God at any time because they weren't fit to be in his presence. And there were very careful rules given. And among these, God lighted the fire on the altar the first time it was set up. And thereafter, they were to keep that fire started by God burning perpetually, always replenishing the fuel. And each time that they burnt incense before him or lighted another fire on the altar, it was to be with this perpetual fire that had not gone out. Leviticus 9, verse 24, recalls that God lighted that first fire. But now Leviticus 10, verses 1 and 2. These two sons of Aaron, they were going to offer incense, and they didn't bother getting the correct fire to put in their censers. They just lighted some fire and blundered ahead. So it says in Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron took either of them his censer and put fire therein and put incense thereon and offered strange fire before Yahweh, which he commanded them not. And there went out fire from Yahweh and devoured them, and they died before Yahweh. Well, other instances of this are mentioned in a number of places. In Numbers 11, verse 1. Now, it's a curious thing, although I guess we're that dumb today, too. Here were these people who had seen the many miracles worked before they left Egypt. Every step of the way since they left Egypt had been just one miracle after another. They saw the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, every single day without missing it. They saw a number of other miracles, but you couldn't get them to take God seriously. And so in one instance where they were rebelling, you read, "And when the people complained, it displeased Yahweh. And Yahweh heard it, and his anger was kindled. And the fire of Yahweh burnt among them and consumed them that were in the outermost parts of the camp." So, first of all, we have a record that this did happen. Then you come to prophecies of what is going to happen in time that is still future to this day. A prophecy that the end of this age, wrongly translated world, of course, in your King James Version, it has nothing to do with the planet. It's the Greek word cosmos, which means an arrangement or order, and therefore means what we laughingly call a civilization today, and has nothing to do with the planet Earth. Now, Isaiah 30, verses 27 to 33, Moffat's translation is especially good on this, so I'm going to read this out of Moffat. "Here comes the Eternal from afar in blazing wrath, with heavy thunder clouds, with angry foam upon his lips, and a tongue like a devouring fire, breathing fury like a flood that reaches to the neck, to sift the nations till they are undone, to drive men with a halter to their doom. Then shall a song be yours, like to the song on a festival night, as joyous men who with music are moving to Israel's great God, to the Eternal's hill. And the Eternal will thunder in triumph and swing his arm down plain in a fury of anger, with flames that devour, storming with hail and with rain. At the Eternal's voice of thunder, the Assyrians are appalled. Now you remember I've told you before how the various prophecies dealing with the Assyrians, not back in Bible times, but describing things that have not happened until our own period here, they coincide exactly with the Bible prophecies concerning Russia. Now, all the ruins that we've found of the old Assyrian cities, where there have been palaces with their beautifully decorated walls with glazed tile, where they have shown in the work of their own best artists what they themselves, the Assyrians, looked like, those faces were typical hook-nosed Jews, regular pawn shop Jews. Now we know that after the fall of the Assyrian Empire, the survivors of them fled northeast into southwestern Russia, the same places where Stalin, for example, came from. And we know that their descendants, these Jews in Russia, are the absolute masters of communist Russia today. So in speaking of these Assyrians, it is the descendants of these people, the same race. At the Eternal's voice of thunder, the Assyrians are appalled. He fights them to the death and clubs them down to peals of merry music. The pyre to burn them is prepared, both deep and wide, piled high with logs set blazing by the breath of the Eternal like a fiery tide. Again in Isaiah 66, verses 15 and 16, for behold, Yahweh will come with fire and with his chariots like a whirlwind to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and with his sword will Yahweh plead with all flesh, and those slain by Yahweh shall be many. So, when the communists think they're starting pretty rough times for us, it's going to turn into pretty rough times for them. But God promises us that through this period of judgment by fire on them, we are going to be kept safe. You notice in that 30th chapter of Isaiah, speaking of the terrific judgment by fire, but speaking of us, then shall a song be yours, like to the song on a festival night, as joyous men who with music are moving to Israel's great God, to the Eternal's hill. So in Isaiah 43, verse 2, he says, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. Now in all these instances here, it's that same Hebrew word, esh, meaning fire. Now the New Testament carries this same theme of eventual judgment by fire upon the wicked, but from which we will be brought out safe. For example, 2 Thessalonians 1, verses 7 and 8. And to you who are troubled, rest with us, when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, of course, this was translated out of the Greek, and the word fire there is the Greek word pur, a primitive word meaning fire. And to show that it does mean it, in John 18, verse 18, that is after Jesus Christ had been captured and dragged off to the high priest's house, and it tells how Peter following, got into the courtyard of the house and warmed himself beside the fire that was burning in the courtyard of the high priest's house. And that fire is this same Greek word, pur. Again, John 21, verse 9. It tells how after the resurrection, the disciples had been out fishing all night and had caught nothing. And so they finally came to the shore with their boat about dawn, and they found Jesus was there on the shore. He told them, cast the net on the right side of the ship, which they did, and remember they made that big catch of 153 large fish. And it says there that Jesus had lighted a fire and had fish and bread cooking on it. And that fire, again, is this same word, pur. So definitely it is fire. Now, I have heard some people trying to laugh off some of this. There seems to be a strong temptation to whittle God down small enough that he can get into the Methodist Church with the rest of them. And, of course, you know, it just wouldn't do that God would really take vengeance on the wicked that way. So they say, well, now that fire, that's only figurative. That's only the Shekinah glory of God. You see, when these wicked people have to be in the presence of God and see his glory, they're going to be embarrassed, and that's going to be their punishment. Can you imagine anything that could embarrass a Jew? Well, in the first place, the word Shekinah is not used even once in the Bible. Some people writing about these things have conjured up that word of their own, but you will find nothing in the Bible using that. And wherever the Bible speaks of judgment by fire, whether in the Hebrew of the Old Testament or the Greek of the New Testament, the word used is identical always with that which they use when they describe regular fire of the kind that burns wood. Well, the Bible has talked about these things happening in the long ago, and the Bible has prophesied that these things are going to happen again. Now, should we be skeptical and say, well, back in those days they were superstitious? Or should we believe that it means what it says? I'm going to go now to some things occurring well within our own period, of which we have definite records, and which show that you haven't heard the half of it. There have been enormous areas blaze up and burn. Now, of course, people speaking of this judgment by fire have said, well, of course, when you get atom and hydrogen bombs dropped, they'll burn up whole cities. That's true. But if you take an ordinary 12-inch diameter globe of the world, the area that would be set afire by the biggest hydrogen bomb ever made would represent nothing but a tiny pinhole on that globe. And that's pretty insignificant compared to the size of all of it. Not insignificant to the guy that's there, but as far as the worldwide judgment is concerned, it doesn't mean much. But now let's see if we have had examples of fire on an enormous scale. Now, all of you have heard of the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. Well, now, Chicago had a telegraph office, and so the news got out. That's the most important news they had, and they kept the wire hot all the time. Every time any little shanty burned, the news of it got out in the telegraph. So that's what got all the publicity. But there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of square miles burned at the same time, towns wiped out with far more loss of life than there was in Chicago, and not much was said about that. But it's all a definite matter of record. There'd been 3 months of drought. Humidity was very low. Then gale winds began blowing. So, on the evening of October 8, 1871, the fire began in Chicago. Now, you've heard the story about Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicking over the lantern and setting some hay afire, and that started the Chicago fire. And it's a nice story, only it isn't true. The Chicago records show that the fire in the O'Leary barn was very quickly brought under control and put out, and it did not spread. But many other fires broke out almost simultaneously. Things were very dry, humidity very low, and the flame spread with a rapidity that simply could not be understood by people accustomed to just ordinary fires. It was something the like of which the fire department had never seen. A building would just burst into flames all over the whole structure as though it were celluloid. It would go up in one big puff. There was one six-story building destroyed in 5 minutes by the watch. And the flame, it kept breaking out every time the fire department rushed to one blaze and thought they could at least get it controlled in that area. A few blocks away, here would be another fire start to blaze up. So there was a lot of damage done, and 250 no one dead. But that was small scale. In Wisconsin, for example, one area of 400 square miles was burned, the whole thing. Brown County, north to near Marinette, along both shores of Green Bay, 1,500 people died in that one. 1,152 died in the one little town of Peshtigo, 2,000 total population. It was described as covering on the west side 15 miles wide by 30 miles northward, on the east side 10 miles wide by 40 miles long to Big Sturgeon Bay. In Michigan, a 1,400 square mile area was burned. 12 towns were completely wiped out, 11 others seriously damaged. There were major fires in the cities of Muskegon, Manistee, Glen Haven, and Holland. Near Holland, Michigan, almost 200 farms were destroyed. There were great forest and prairie fires in parts of Indiana, Iowa, Minnesota. Fire there came within sight of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. In Illinois, North Dakota, and South Dakota. The prairie fire near Yankton, South Dakota, was described by one witness as being a wall of flame 30 feet high, moving as rapidly as a fast horse could run. And there were, in these same days, scattered reports of great fires in the Rocky Mountains and even in parts of the Sierras. Now that's something that makes your hydrogen bomb look pretty puny. And if you get caught in a fire like that, it doesn't matter in the least that there wasn't a hydrogen bomb. The fire is plenty hot to dispose of you. Now, some other things that you will find it not so easy to explain, but they're matters of official record. And more recently, for example, in Spain, during the months of June and July of the year 1945, in and around the little town of La Roda in the province of Almeria, beginning June 16, 1945, something very odd began to happen. White clothing, washed and spread out on the grass to dry, began to catch fire and burn. During the next 20 days, there were about 300 fires started in and around the town, burning barns, storage bins, walls of houses, laundry drying in the fields. And nobody knows the explanation, but in almost all instances, the thing that ignited was white. Why it caught fire at all, nobody knows. Why it preferred to burn white things, nobody knows. But to somebody who had his house burned down, it wasn't superstition, it was fact. July 5th, 1945, the reports say a great column of whirling wind of a luminous brown color struck a small settlement near there with a great roar, set fire to it, kindling flames that leaped about 30 feet high. Now, we have our tornadoes here. You notice what happened recently in the South. But they don't set fire to anything. This is something different, something more than just a mere whirlwind. Well, let's move a little west to Spain, into Portugal. On July 6th, 1949, in the morning, temperature was about 100 degrees, there came a sudden heat wave which first struck the town of Figueira on the central Portuguese coast, and it continued on inland to Coimbra, about 30 miles inland. This heat wave lasted about 2 minutes was all, but temperature as high as 158 degrees was registered in that 2 minute period. No fire started, no loss of human life reported, but there were a good many chickens and ducks killed on the farm. Now, how? Nobody knows. Our scientists cannot explain it. This explanation has been offered as a possibility by some scientists. You've heard about the Van Allen radiation belts around the Earth. The terrific electromagnetic energy thrown off by the sun, if it could get clear through to the Earth, would simply burn out all life here. But the Earth's magnetic field catches this, out a couple of hundred miles out into space, and catches it and turns it into a shell surrounding the Earth. Openings at the two poles, but over the rest of it, a pretty thick belt of this extreme electromagnetic activity. Somebody has suggested, might it not be possible, that some little center of that activity might somehow break loose from the Van Allen belts and, keeping itself together, drop down to Earth, maintaining its terrific activity till it got here. Well, nobody knows. It is suggested as a possibility, but no way to either prove or disprove it. Well, fire over enormous areas. Fire on a big enough scale that it could be quite a useful tool in judgment. That we've seen in our own day. Now what about the very thing the Bible talked about? Fire falling from heaven. And I don't mean lightning, I mean fire. Plenty of examples of that within this century. In England, May 29th, 1938, 9 men working out in an open field were burned by fire that fell on them from a clear sky. Not lightning. They'd been hit by lightning, they'd have been killed. But they simply suffered burn. They said that they saw a ball of fire fall from the sky, and they were burned enough to require medical treatment. So, fire falling from the sky. All right, Belfast, Maine, May 10th, 1963. Quite a number of witnesses saw this. There was a brilliant blue flash in the sky, then the fall of some very brilliant blue light, ball of blue light that fell, which hit the roof of a warehouse. It immediately set fire to it, and the flames burned a 40 by 25 foot hole in the shingles on the roof of this warehouse. Now, of course, the fire department that came and put it out made a very careful search. No metal was found, no chemicals were found, no anything that had fallen from the sky, nothing but the fire that set it afire. All right. April 28, 1965, near Sudbury, Massachusetts. A number of witnesses, including a trooper in the state police force, these witnesses scattered over a considerable area on all sides of this, saw what one witness described as looking like a flaming basketball, a round ball of fire, fall from the sky. It hit a large barn, which was totally destroyed. The fire chief said it was definitely not from any natural cause, because the entire building burst into flames instantly. Not just starting at one spot and spreading, but the whole thing just went up in one puff as though it had been celluloid. And coming down out of the sky. Many witnesses saw it. All right. In Parajavara in Lapland, Finland, July 29th, 1938, quite a number of fireballs fell from the sky. It was an overcast sky, but no storm. Five houses were hit and destroyed, several others damaged. One person burned to death. Several other people received burns. Fire seemed to fall from the sky. Not bombs. They would have left bits of metal and traces of chemicals and so on. Just fire. In Australia, in the month of November, 1902. For a couple of months before that, vast areas over the ocean were covered with smoke, making navigation quite difficult between the Philippine Islands and Australia, and also in the China Sea. Evidently, smoke of volcanic origin, because there are, of course, a number of volcanoes in that part of the world. Later, this smoke turned into a dust storm of fine, powdery red dust. November 12, 1902, fireballs began falling all over Australia, except in one province of Queensland. They started numerous fires in every district in the provinces of Victoria and New South Wales, in many of the cities and towns. By November 13, 1902, fireballs began falling even in Queensland, and in many of the towns, houses were hit and destroyed by this falling fire. After November 14th, terrific thunderstorms began clearing the air of the smoke and dust, but for 10 days after that, fireballs continued to fall out of the sky. On November 20th, 1902, Sir Charles Todd at the Adelaide Astronomical Observatory, with some other of the men there with him as witnesses, saw one fireball in the sky moving so slowly that he and these other witnesses watched it for 4 minutes. Now, a meteor, you know, goes so fast, it's just one flash and it's gone. A meteor that would be visible for 2 seconds would be extremely rare. And this thing drifted along, burning under observation for 4 minutes. Now, don't tell the people in Australia whose homes were burned by these things that that was superstition. It wasn't. It was fire. And it burned their houses. March 9th, 1957, a Pan American World Airways liner on the New York to Puerto Rico run, when it was off Jacksonville, Florida, was nearly struck by what the pilot called a huge fireball advancing with tremendous speed. He managed to dodge it, but he had to throw his ship into such violent maneuver that a stewardess and a woman passenger, who didn't have their seat belts buckled, were injured enough to require hospitalization. So, fire? Yeah, real fire. Let's see some of the things that the New Testament tells us now about this coming judgment by fire. 2 Peter 3, verses 7, 10, and 12. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also, and the works that are therein, shall be burned up. The coming day of God, wherein the heavens, being on fire, shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Now, where it says fire, it's that Greek word pur, which, as we have seen, is used where you're speaking of a bonfire or a cooking fire. And where it says, where the heavens, being on fire, it's the Greek word puro, which means to kindle or be ignited. Now, in Matthew 3, verses 11 to 12, this is John the Baptist speaking now. I indeed baptize you with water unto repentance, but he that comes after me is mightier than I, whose shoes I am not worthy to bear. He shall baptize you with the Holy Spirit and with fire, whose fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor and gather his wheat into the garner, but he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire. Now this is talking about the fire that comes not as a matter of a few hours' judgment here, but the fire that is reserved for the wicked forever thereafter. Unquenchable fire, and that's that same Greek word, pur. Now, Jesus Christ's own words, Matthew 18, verses 8 and 9. Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off and cast them from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life halt or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life with one eye, rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire. Now both everlasting fire and hell fire there, the word fire was this same Greek word, pur. Fire. Hot. Unpleasant. But it's not going to be a matter merely of embarrassment. It's going to be much more than that. So as we can see from what has happened, well-established incidents, all within the last century, that sort of thing does happen in our own times and can well happen when it's a matter of God's judgment. But now suppose some of these wicked people who have gotten very rich say, oh, well, we can afford to build us good, deep, reinforced concrete bomb shelters where we'll be out of reach of any of these fireballs dropping from the sky. They can, but I've got news for them. They won't be safe there. I'm going to tell you something now that probably most of you have not heard. It is, however, a well-established fact, established by the records of a good many coroner's inquests, at which they have had testimony from the best expert witnesses that could be found. And that is that there are, I would say, over 100 definitely established instances of a human body breaking out into fire by spontaneous combustion and being burned just to powdery ashes.
and that in a brief period of time.
Now, the human body is something close to 95% water. If you roll up a newspaper and soak it overnight in the tub of water, what you take out will have perhaps less water in proportion than the human body. Now, you put that roll of soggy, wet newspaper in your fireplace and try to burn it, and you know what a job you've got. You can't do it until, as you gradually dry it out, one sheet of paper at a time, gradually you reach the point where it burns. So, only as the human body can be dried out by terrific heat can it be burned by ordinary chemical fire. Now, the crematories, where bodies are cremated, well, they wouldn't be efficient enough to accomplish anything if they didn't get their temperature well over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And most of them are set up for about a 2,500 degree temperature. And in a temperature of 2,500 degrees, it takes from 3 to 4 hours to burn away the flesh, burning it to ashes. And even then, you have left a complete skeleton with every bone recognizable. Now, it's perfectly true that the skeleton has been charred. And if you went in and stepped on one of those bones, you could crumble it to powder. But the point is that unless you do that, here is a bone of its original size and shape, perfectly recognizable as a human bone, and any physician knowing the human anatomy could tell you which bone it was. Now, with that in mind, note some of these well-established incidents. There have been scattered references to this in scientific papers over a period of several centuries. The English novelist Charles Dickens, in one of his novels, had one character die from burning up from spontaneous combustion. Of course, people raised their eyebrows and said, well, that was just too melodramatic. Nothing like that could happen. But he said that before undertaking to write such a thing, he had put in a lot of time on various careful research on it, and that he had found about 30 officially recorded cases where no other explanation could be found.